Are pets good for your health? Zoonotic diseases aside, does having a cat or dog make you happier? More likely to do some exercise, perhaps? Does the kind of pet make a difference? This week, a new Christmas research paper published on BMJ.com has looked into that, using a pre-existing cohort that's been used for other studies on aging. I'm Duncan Jarvis, multimedia editor for the BMJ, and I'm joined by Richard Watt, professor of dental public health at University College London, and one of the authors of that paper. Richard, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, with our Christmas research, it's usually on a silly topic, perhaps done with fairly robust methodology. But this one seems like more of an important question to actually ask. Why was it you decided to look at it?
Well, the group of researchers from UCL and Cambridge, we're public health researchers, and our interest is on health inequalities, factors influencing health, and we're also interested in social dimensions. So one element is looking at pets and its potential beneficial effects in older people across England, and that's what we looked at, because the existing research is quite mixed on the effects of pets and whether they have a beneficial effect or not.
Mm. So you didn't have anything a priori going in that you expected to see from this?
Well, maybe I should reveal conflict of interest at this point. As a dog owner, I felt very strongly, and I've got a beautiful dog, so I was looking, hopefully, for results that would confirm the love of my dog. So perhaps that's our declaration of conflict of interest.
Yes. Not a financial one, but an emotional one.
An emotional one, indeed.
I suppose I was the same. I'm thinking back to my parents. Now they've just retired. They have two dogs. They take them for walks for miles every day. And I think they're probably more healthy than they have been for a while because of that. But when you looked at this, and when you kind of, can you give us an overall picture of what you found when you did delve into the data?
Yeah, so what we did was we analysed data from the English Longitudinal Study of Ageing. So that's a national sample of older people in England. And our sample, when we investigated the data, were just under 70 years old, so 69 years old. And we found out at their level of ownership of pets, and about a third had either a cat or a dog or other pets. And what we did 2 years later, at this next wave of the data, is use data collected by nurses who collect clinical markers in the sample. And perhaps what's interesting with this study is we looked at physical function markers, we looked at psychological markers, memory and depressive symptoms, and we also looked at some blood biomarkers, so comprehensive range of markers of aging. And to really assess if those people with a pet had any beneficial effects across those different biomarkers. And surprisingly, we found a consistent result of no association between these biomarkers and pet ownership.
Did it matter what kind of pet? Because, as you say, a dog is probably quite different having a cat.
Well, we looked at separately at dogs and cats, and there was some slight differences, but nothing really that significant differences. So again, surprisingly, because with dogs, as you mentioned, in terms of physical activity, potential social interaction with people when you're out walking dogs, those mechanisms you could imagine may have more of an effect for dogs. But in our analysis, we did not find any big differences. And also importantly, in our analysis, we adjusted for a range of important factors that may influence that association, such as heights and weights, but also markers of social isolation and indicators of loneliness. And again, with all that analysis, our results really didn't find any major differences.
That's interesting. So we'll get into, you know, what that might mean in a little bit. But you mentioned some of the kind of things that you were looking at. And so if we look at those sort of physical signs of aging, things like gait speed and chair rise time and grip strength, there's a lot in there, obviously.
Yeah.
What are they actually trying to measure? What, you know, So it doesn't really matter
to
someone how quickly they get voted for chair. But you know, we use that to look at something else.
Well, these really are standard physiological measures of people's physical function.
Mm-hmm.
And with aging, clearly things like standing ability, balance, grip strength will diminish over time. And these markers are used just really as functional physical markers of people's abilities in a range of different ways. So they're really precursors to future disease state, etc. So they are important, and they give an indication of people's well-being and function and independence to some extent as well.
Mm. And you mentioned already psychological things that you measured, so it was memory and a depression index.
Symptoms, yep.
But then you also had some social things that you adjusted for, so loneliness and things like that. So how were they measured?
Well, the loneliness is measured in an internationally recognized scale, the UCLA scale, which is a recognized loneliness measure many use in big surveys around the world. In terms of social isolation, what we did was look at a range of different markers of social isolation. For example, relationship status, whether people lived alone. So it was a composite measure of a range of different measures to assess people's level of isolation or not. So again, it was a comprehensive assessment. And this is one of the strengths of the ELSA survey, that they have very good quality data on such things as social isolation.
Hmm. Now, going back to the results, you said that there wasn't a big difference, but as you said at the beginning, you thought there would be. I'm sure my parents would swear blind that the dogs make them more healthy. So I'm just wondering, what might be going on? What might be explaining that kind of the difference between what we think or what people who own pets feel and those kind of the measures that you've got there?
Well, I suppose it comes back down to that really what we might feel or anticipate, we need to really evidence-based in terms of research. And the existing literature is quite mixed on the findings of pet ownership. And although those pathways seem very obvious and really sort of rational, our data really is a comprehensive assessment of these issues. And I suppose also the consistency of results across these 11 different biomarkers mean it's not just by chance that we didn't find anything. Across these physical, physiological and blood markers, we've got consistency of result. So I'm pretty confident that our analysis is robust. It's very, it's a big national sample, representative sample of older people. As always, there's some limitations. So, for example, we didn't measure levels of stress. So we could have assessed stress, and you could argue companionship, petting an animal is a good way of relaxing, and some data has suggested that, but we weren't able to assess that in this particular analysis. Also, we had very limited data on the nature of the pet. So I don't know about your parents' dog, but if you've got a little lap dog, you're not going to go walking far with them, whereas larger dogs, you would go for long walks. So we couldn't really differentiate the effect of the pet because we've got quite limited information about the nature of the pet.
And I suppose that's always a limitation of doing a large cohort study, is that you have to be selective about the data that you collect, and you can't sit down and talk to individuals about, you can, but it'd be incredibly expensive to sit down and talk to all the individuals in this study about how the pets have affected their life on a day-to-day basis.
Well, that's where other studies could use different methodologies, such as qualitative research, where you could explore that in a different way with a different research question. So I suppose what we're saying is it doesn't mean there's no effect. Just with our analysis, we couldn't detect a major difference. But further research, either qualitative to explore people's experiences, could be important, or even, not very easy, but doing interventional studies to see if you could tease out if is there an association there or not. That could be another way forward in terms of research.
And I suppose this is down to complexity. Pet ownership is multivariate, as you've said, and very hard to measure all the things that would potentially be beneficial or harmful from doing that. And I just wonder, I mean, this is a slightly more philosophical thought, but you've come to this using particular biomarkers of physical ability, health status, using, you know, blood work and things. I'm framing it within that kind of medical model, pushes us to think within a medical model about this population. And I'm just wondering, you know, the BMJ's got a campaign against too much medicine and things. And we've been spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, where we stand and how we conceptualize a lot of these things. And I just wonder, you know, big cohort studies like this, where we have to be selective in the data that we choose, they might end up pushing us in a certain direction. And public health generally, perhaps, in a certain direction.
I think that's a very important point. And I think, you know, we are a public health research community of people that have done this of the study. And our main interest is actually looking at the broader determinants, social determinants that influences the health of the population. So the concerns you're raising really ring very true within our research agenda. And some of the cohort studies are very clinical in their nature because where the funding source comes, etc. But with the English Longitudinal Study of Aging, it actually is a very good example of cross-disciplinary research. And the real strengths of that longitudinal study is the data on wealth, socioeconomic position, social relationships. It is a really wonderful study to look into those other broader factors that influence health. And indeed, many of the work we do at UCL taps into those other mechanisms. So although in this paper we've used those biomarkers, and I think it's a fair point, ELSA enables researchers to really look more broadly. And there are many papers being published from the ELSA data set that explore those broader social determinants of health and well-being.
And this was a fairly new cohort. It was after 2000 it was set up?
Yeah, relatively new, yep.
What's some of that thinking kind of built in at the beginning of this when you decided what to measure and what data to collect, essentially?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And I wasn't involved at the beginning of that study, but Professor Michael Marmot, Professor James Nasru from University of Manchester, various people were involved at initiating the study. And the whole basis of this particular cohort is to consider the broader determinants of older people's health. So the research questions are really framed in that broader agenda. So and the funding comes from multiple sources, including US money, but also from different research agencies that are not just biomedical in their focus. So I think your concerns, this study in particular, this cohort, really is trying to address some of those broader factors.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking, and this is a very UK perspective, health and social care and, you know, that sort of, they were very separate. But now we're seeing in Scotland, it's becoming much more integrated. In Manchester, where they've kind of devolved a lot of that stuff, it's becoming much more integrated. And policymakers and things, commissioners, whomever is involved there, are trying to really think about, you know, what matters to people in a way that is moving away from a biomedical model. And I'm just wondering about the sort of changing role of public health in that sphere. And I mean, do you feel like public health has changed a little bit?
Well, I think, I mean, this is sort of going on to a broader agenda, but I think public health in England is going through a difficult time in terms of funding, because moving into local authorities, although from a philosophical and a practical element, local authorities are a very important place to be, the funding pressures on local authorities is extreme. And we know that there's been major cuts in public health funding across the country. Now, agencies like Public Health England and others are doing a good job, but it's a difficult time for public health practitioners working in the field, so to speak. But public health has to engage with other agencies, and local authorities, education authorities, etc., are really important partners. So the health service is one element that influences our health at a population level, but these other housing departments, you know, economic issues are so much more important. So I think public health has to work across those agencies, and that's the sort of mainstream of public health work. But with funding cuts that are happening, they are under enormous pressure.
I suppose what I was meaning is that public health is the place that these things do actually join up, where that sort of overarching thinking is happening already.
Yeah.
And that's a space where practitioners and things, you know, need to leverage that overview to actually make a difference.
Well, you're correct. And I think one of the roles of public health is advocacy. So as an advocate for population health concerns, so whether that's to do with poverty, discrimination, poor housing quality, public health practitioners, their voice should be pressurizing, lobbying policymakers around those different areas that we know are very important for health. And again, I suppose one of the concerns is how much autonomy do some public health practitioners have? Academics tend to have more freedom and are more able to speak up. But if you're in a system that is being managed very closely, that freedom to speak up and talk, you know, challenge authority and power figures is an important one. But I suppose most importantly, and in Scotland it works very well, is that cross-departmental, you know, working across disciplines is fundamentally important, and that's where public health should have an important role.
So we've moved on there quite far from pet ownership, but it was an interesting chat. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Richard Watt talk about his study into the biomarkers of ageing and pet ownership, which is now available on bmj.com. Before we finish, it's time to remind you that Christmas is a time of giving. And this year's Christmas appeal is for MSF. In previous years, the BMJ's readers have been very generous to help our charities, and we urge you to do that again. Here's Javed Abdelmonim, emergency medicine doctor and chair of MSF UK, to explain why BMJ's chosen MSF this year and why you should donate.
Well, MSF was involved from the very beginning of this Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and it was in fact through an MSF laboratory that the blood sampling was tested and diagnosed with Ebola. From that very moment of the diagnosis having been made, MSF set about making reacting to it with containment teams and treatment centres. And we can react in, and we do, we mandate ourselves to react in natural disaster, in disease epidemic, in conflict settings, and in areas where there's health imbalance. So, you know, we were the first to bring out antiretroviral drugs for HIV in Southern Africa. We, you know, way back when, you know, 2-3 decades ago, we in Khayelitsha in South Africa, you know, and we continue that sort of trailblazing now by trialing MDR, multi-drug resistant tuberculosis drugs, bringing it out for the first time, the compassionate use of bedaquiline in Armenia 3 years ago, and helping form the new World Health guidelines for tuberculosis and drug resistant tuberculosis last year. So, you know, that could be HIV, TB, disease burdens of exclusion or inequity or imbalance. But then look at the Haiti earthquake. You know, what a huge response we made then. Or look at Ebola, what a huge response we made then. Or look at Syria and Yemen, where we're working now. We really are, you know, unique in the sense of being able to do all those different complex things at the same time. There's no point us having logisticians and medics doing things and advocacy campaigns and petitions if, you know, we can't do any of that without having money. So I don't want to sound crass, but, you know, at the end of the day, if we didn't have money, we wouldn't be able to do any of this. And that's why we do do appeals, you know, and we won't be shy in saying, give us as much as you can, because do you know what? We do a very good job. And if I don't say so myself, and we'd like to continue doing such a good job, because more often than not, we'll be the only people there giving that care, you know, in the north of Yemen, in the backwaters of South Sudan, in other forgotten places. You know, Uganda took in 1 million South Sudanese refugees. Their millionth refugee cost went into Sudan, from South Sudan into Uganda this year. Was that even in the headlines? Who's working there? Who's helping Uganda? Well, you can bet your bottom dollar and pound and euro that MSF is there. You know, and again for Rohingya in Myanmar and so forth. So, no, I'll gladly say if you feel like helping and you can't in any other way than giving a pound, we'd gladly receive it.
The easiest way to donate is online, msf.org.uk/bmj. £123 could pay for a blood transfusion for 3 people. £65 could buy a stretcher to help move an injured person to safety, and £54 could provide the antibiotics needed to treat 50 war wounded people. That's it for our Christmas podcast for this year. We're going to be back between Christmas and New Year. Some education for you to keep up with some festive CPD, and we'll also have a roundup talking to the great and good about what they would like to see happen in 2018. Subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on that. I'm Duncan Jarvis, Multimedia Editor for the BMJ. Thanks for listening.